other religions like Christianity and Judaism as well.
Fast is just about going without.
Yvonne Ridley is an activist who has reverted to Islam.
Of course, there is fasting in Christianity, but it's more symbolic now. Both Moses and Jesus fasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and we're told that they went without food and water. It was really quite a marathon. Christians, in the run-up to their Easter, go through a period of fasting called Lent, in which they give up something. Quite often it's something like cigarettes or chocolate. So it's quite symbolic, and it's not the daily test that Muslims put themselves through by simply not eating, not drinking, avoiding confrontational situations, having no physical sexual contact and the like.
Layla is an American living in Iran who converted to Islam years ago. She says Islam gave her life direction.
At the time, I was actually searching for a purpose in life, a goal, a direction in life. I knew that Christianity, I was Christian, didn't give me the answers that I really wanted. It wasn't specific enough for me. I wanted something that gave me a reason for why we're here, a purpose. And I liked Islam because it is the most complete religion, and there is a rule or a prescription or a goal for everything you do, an explanation. And that suited what I was looking for.
When Muslims fast, they refrain from eating and drinking all the daylight hours. For a first-time faster, this is a challenging experience, especially when they have to go to work as usual, rain or shine.
Basically, for me, it was a very strange experience. It's sort of exciting, but a little bit difficult to start with, because as you're first starting to fast, you've never really experienced this, not having this ability to, not being allowed to eat or drink anything all day long. So it was a very unique experience the first year. I was wondering at the beginning, I had a doubt if I would be able to actually fast that, because it was more like late summer, fall, and I had a doubt as well if I would be able to fast the number of hours, because I hadn't ever done it before. And after the first two or three days of adjusting to it, you realize that it's very easy, and you actually look forward to fasting. So it was a little bit of excitement, apprehension a little bit. Can I do this? Can I not do this? How does everybody else do it in a warm climate? You know, just a lot of questions for me to start with for the first time. But as the days went by and you get into this routine, you realize how easy that Allah makes it for you when you fast. It's not difficult, and you learn for the right reasons.
Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. O my Allah, for thee I fast, and with the food thou givest me, I break the fast, and I rely on thee.
There are certain things a person who is fasting must not do, but they are only the physical aspects of what's going on within the person's heart and mind. In Islamic countries, the fasting month is a national event, and everyone's in the Ramadan spirit. Naturally, this makes fasting more enjoyable and not eating or drinking more tolerable. But in secular countries, it might be more difficult to fast. Europe has more than 44 million Muslims, and the Americas has around 5 million.
I started my fasting at 4 o'clock in the morning, and of course my family, they are going to be hungry at 12 or 1, and they are going to want to eat their lunch. So in a way, it's quite difficult, especially when you are not used to it, to see people eating in front of you and you yourself having to wait. But I think in un-Islamic countries, one thing that converts habit to is that they see all these things happening. They see the most un-Islamic things happening in their countries, in their homes, in their cities. That once they have it, it is easier for them to do a fasting compared to a person who was born a Muslim in an Islamic country or un-Islamic country. So, people get used to that. People get used to it, to see people in the streets drinking ice-cold water or eating delicious foods and you're fasting.
It's quite a difficult time for converts to Islam in the West. Very often their families don't support them, are almost hostile to their reversion to Islam. And because there is so much excitement to the build-up for most Muslims, sometimes converts can get forgotten about. And so they have to cope on their own. And it can be quite a difficult time for Muslims.
Muslims don't only fast during Ramadan. Some also fast voluntarily on the 13th, 14th and 15th of Rajab, the seventh month of the lunar Islamic calendar. Muslims spend 3 days in the mosque praying. It's a form of spiritual retreat called i'tikaf that the Holy Quran and Hadith recommend. Lots of students came to the mosque in the University of Tehran to perform their 3-day i'tikaf. There is also a social aspect to fasting. Community spirit and unity are an important part of Ramadan. Millions of people stop eating at one precise moment and start eating again with the sound of the azan. People give alms to the poor and visit family and friends in the holy month to break their fast together.
I think Islam gives us this opportunity to fast once a year to increase that awareness, that heightened sense of your neighbors and community and society, and that ability to help others becomes more aware during Ramadan, because then we begin to feel what sometimes our neighbors are feeling, whereas we may be so busy the rest of the year that we're not aware of that, or we take it with a grain of salt, as we would say. We know it's there, we know it exists, but we still go on with our daily lives.
It is a time for great reflection, and it's a time when you think of brothers and sisters across the world and how they spend their Ramadan and how they spend their fasting. And of course, for a large section of the Ummah, hunger is no stranger to them. There are brothers and sisters out there who survive maybe on just one meal a day. Especially in places like Niger, which is often blighted by famine.
The fasting month has some very important nights, the most holy being the nights of Qadr. Muslims believe 1400 years ago on these very nights, the Holy Quran was revealed in full to Prophet Muhammad. Muslims pray and read the Joshan Kabir, Joshan Sagir, and Mujir, among other prayers. They believe they are more likely to be answered on these nights.
This Ramadan, during Laylat al-Qadr, which is indeed a very holy night, or three very holy nights, I would like to ask God for curing many issues that are that have happened in the world, such as the wars in countries like Syria, or people losing their jobs in any part of the world. But one personal thing that I would like to ask is for forgiveness, because I think that every person, even if he tries not to commit a sin, is not able to not commit a sin, because we're not mas'oom. We are not unfailable. We are human, and human do mistakes. And if people do mistakes and they regret their mistakes, they do not repeat them. So I think it's a good occasion to ask God for forgiveness and to not repeat those mistakes, and keep the connection to God that you have re-established in the holy month of Ramadan in the first 20 days and in the last 10 days of that month.
Savior.
Oh, the Savior of mankind, please show us a sign.
To the designer of the human civilization that is established on the unity of Almighty Allah.
Almighty Allah, you are our true God.
To the redeemer of human volition and thought.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. This is The Last Savior. I am your humble host, Zainab. Dear listeners, as you know, we have been discussing about Mahdawiyat, Imam Mahdi, in this session. We have with us Dr. Karimi. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
So Dr. Karimi, we had been discussing in previous session that Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala faraja is from the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam, and even if he is from the lineage of Imam Hassan alayhi salam, you prove that how beautifully proving the point that lineage is not only from fathers, lineage can be also from mothers, not stretching on the senseless, useless points, not stretching on the narrations that have incomplete chain, not stressing on the narrations that have incomplete content, like what a Wahhabi scholar did in proving the point that Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala faraja belongs to the lineage of Imam Hassan al-Mujtaba alayhi salam. Well, we came up with a number of narrations in previous sessions, and we proved that, and we came up with one authentic narration from Shia schools as well, and we proved that Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala faraja is from the lineage of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Now in today's session, I would want to ask you very, very interesting thing about the disappearance and reappearance of Imam. We have some sources saying that Imam Mahdi ajallahu ta'ala farajahum, he disappeared from the basement. Where will he reappear? Because there are some narrations that say that he will reappear in Kaaba.
First of all, let me talk about what these basement or
what Sardab, we call a Sardab,
exactly,
yeah,
is all about, or holy Sardab or holy basement. You know, in that time, and even up today, we see it in some hot regions of the world, that in some cities of Baghdad, because they were very hot during the summer, it was a custom among the people that next to their houses, they also dug a basement, because it's cooler to stay in the basement, especially during the hot days of the summer.
All right.
So it was a place of living for special days of the year, especially during the summer. And it's not only something special about Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
All right.
As I mentioned, up until today, you can find even in our country, in Iran, in some places that
we have basements.
Yeah,
here.
They have,
yeah,
a kind of basement, because it's, as I mentioned,
a cooler place
during,
yeah,
the,
especially during the summers.
So when Imam Hadi alayhi salam, and after him his son Imam Haskari alayhi salam, they lived in the city of Samarra. Next to their house or their rooms, they also had that sardab, that basement, to just go there when it's
really hot.
Yeah, very hot. And it was not something special to them.
All right.
And it was a custom for all the people. Now, is it a holy place? Yes, because it is a place that three imams lived there.
All right.
And it is like the house of the Prophet. Is it a holy place? Of course, yes, for all the Muslims, not only for the Shia. It is a holy place because our Prophet has lived there for a couple of years. Even some places are only known for the fact that, for example, a holy person has stepped there only once. It is considered as a holy place, not only from, I mean, Muslims' perspective. Imagine if Christians are told that Jesus has come to this place and has passed only one night, in this place. For sure, they will take it also as
They'll
a holy place.
They'll use the streets to find each and every place where
exactly.
Jesus went, yeah.
So the point is that three imams have lived in this place.
All right.
So this place is only holy for us because of that. And mm-hmm. It is something shared, I mean, by maybe all the followers of divine religions. They take as holy the places where, I mean, holy people used to live. The same is like, I mean, the places where, I mean, Buddha used to live for the Buddhists and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So this is the only point why we take this Sardab as a holy place.
Holy place, all right.
Is it the place for the disappearance of Imam Mahdi alayhi salam? No.
Dr. Karimi, I'll be talking to you here. We need to take a short break. The listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
That Sardab, that basement, is it the place where Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear from? No. But it is very, very weird that we see many Sunni scholars who all have claimed that Mahdi, who is believed by the Shia as the savior, he will reappear from Sardab. And they are waiting for him now next to the Sardab. In today's session, I would like to mention a couple of the
narrations. That's
not
that.
Narrations, the words of some of the Sunni scholars.
Right.
And really, for me, it's so strange that how they have made up this story, because you cannot find in any of Shia sources anything about that. I'm not talking about the narrations. There is no narration in this regard that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will reappear from Sardab. Inshallah, we'll come to that part. But before that, let me just share some of the words of some of the Sunni scholars with all respect to them. But the point is that it's very weird. How did you come with this? Maybe it was made up by one person and then was narrated by the next generations.
All right.
So if I may call it, it's only a big lie against the beliefs of the Shia.
Yeah.
And the next point is that the way they have put it, they are making fun of the Shia. Let me share with you some of these phrases. For example, Ibn Khallakan, the famous Sunni scholar in the 7th century after Hijrah, he passed away in 681. He says that the Shia say that and believe that Mahdi entered the Sardab or the basement in his father's house, and he disappeared while his mother was looking at him, and no one saw him from that time anymore. And this happened in the year 265 after Hijrah, and in that time he was 9 years old. And all of them are, I mean, against the Shia beliefs.
All right.
We know that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was born in 255. And his minor occultation began, according to Shia sources, in 260, when Imam Mahdi alayhi salam was only 5 years old.
All right.
This is in Wafayatul A'yam, the famous book by Ibn Khallakan, volume 4, page 176. Now, Ibn Taymiyyah, who is the forefather of Wahhabi school of thought, and he's very famous for his anti-Shia beliefs, in his Minhaj al-Sunnat al-Nabawiyyah, he even goes to extreme in this regard as well, and he calls it a kind of foolish action of the Shia.
All right.
He says, وَمِنْ حِمَاقَتِهِمْ, one of the stupid actions of the Shia is the following. He says that, let me share also one point that when we refer to the books of some of the Sunni scholars and some of the Wahhabi scholars, some of them, they have mentioned that this Sardab is in the city of Samarra.
All right.
Which is true. But it is also weird that some of them, they have claimed that this Sardab is in the city of Baghdad, and some have claimed that it is in the city of Hilla.
All right.
So for Baghdad, one may answer that they are close to each other to some extent.
Okay.
But when it comes to Hilla, it's, I mean, they are far from each other. So this is another weird point.
All right.
So let's go to Ibn Taymiyyah. He says that, sorry for translating, but this is the word of this Wahhabi scholar or the forefather of Wahhabi school of thought. He says that one of the stupid actions of the Shia is that they have decided, they have mentioned some places for their Mahdi and they are waiting for him in those places. One of them is Sardab in Samarra. They believe that he has disappeared from that place.
Okay.
Then he continues, he says that the Shia, they have taken some animals like horses into this place, Sardab, so that as soon as Imam Mahdi alayhi salam reappears from Sardab, they are ready to go and help Imam Mahdi alayhi salam.
Oh my God.
They gather in this place every morning and every evening and they call out, "Oh, our master, come to us, come to us," and then they take their swords and weapons out of their sheath and without seeing any person to be there to fight with.
Oh my God.
And then
I can feel your eyes like the sun shining behind the clouds. I need a morning to shatter this long night forever. I need a hero to stop this thousand-year-old pain.
So let's go to Ibn Taymiyyah. He continues to say that among the Shia are some people who they abandon saying salat, saying prayer, out of fear that maybe during our prayer it's possible that Imam Mahdi alayhi salam will come and we are not able to help him.
All right.
You see how, I mean, big the lie is. And he says that it's not only about Sardab in the city of Samarra, there are in some other cities as well. Each year at the end of the month of Ramadan, they turn their faces toward the east and then they ask for help from Imam Mahdi alayhi salam and the rest of the story. This is in the book Minhaj al-Sunnat al-Nabawiyyah, volume 1, page 44 and page 45.
Well, I must say that Ibn Taymiyyah, who has, I guess, taken the mission of saying anti-Shia slogans and, I don't know, coming up with claims that are baseless, is using a trick over here that's called, I as a media student know, this trick is called a big lie trick.
Exactly.
And that trick was used to say, like, you know, we still, some people in the world believe that Neil Armstrong was the first person to land on the moon. However, there was no person ever to land on the moon.
Yeah.
And this was during the, you know, when the United States felt during the Soviet era that Russia is going to be more powerful country, so they need a big lie to be dominant. And I think Ibn Taymiyyah is actually scared, maybe, because seeing the Shia school of thought being more authentic, being more talking about justice and all, about Salat, and now he's coming out with the tricks of big lies. And I went to Sardab too, and I never saw any horses or animals or anything like that there. It's a good place. It's a basement like every other basement. I mean, I personally went there. That's what I would like to share with the listeners. I went to the basement. It's a normal basement. It's a normal place. However, it's a holy place, considered to be holy because Imams have lived there. That's it.
Next to him, I mean, after him, you have Ibn al-Qayyim, another Sunni scholar or Wahhabi scholar who is also famous for his anti-Shia beliefs. He also says the following. He says that the Rafidis, that is the Shia, they believe that Mahdi is Muhammad, son of Imam al-Askari, alayhi salam, and one of the offspring of Imam al-Husayn, alayhi salam. He entered the Sardab while he was, a child. And then he says the following. It's for about 500 years that no one has seen this Mahdi, no one has heard any news about him, And but the Shia, they are waiting for him, and every day they are waiting for him next to the Sardar, and they are calling him to come out and to help them, but they return to their homes disappointed, and this is their habit. They're doing that on a daily basis. And as you rightly mentioned, I mean, no one has seen the Shia to do that even once. So it's very strange
It's strange, you know, you said 500 years. I mean, if a person does a repetitive thing, gets disappointed, he goes once, twice, thrice, and once he's disappointed.
That's a good point as well.
I mean, like 500 years is like, it's a senseless thing to believe.
And Ibn al-Qayyim al-Jawziyah, he continues with some bad words against the Shia. I'm not going to say that. He refers to a poet regarding Sardab, and he mentions that this is the Sardab that you're waiting for a man, and you are waiting for Sardab to give birth to a person that you are waiting for.
Oh.
So this is another big lie mentioned by Ibn al-Qayyim al-Jawzi.
So until next session, I bid you farewell. From my end and from Dr. Karimi's end, take good care of yourself. With that, this is Zainab with the whole team saying goodbye. Where is the rising sun? Where is the spring of life? Where is the shining moon? Where is the firmest glow? Please, oh please, please come.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime's repression of human rights workers will only escalate as the investigation progresses and with no pushback from the regime's allies, who seem happy to uphold international law when it suits them. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written by Maureen Claire Murphy, journalist. This article is published under the heading International Silence Fuels Israeli Regime Persecution. Stay tuned for more. The Zionist regime's recent designation of several prominent Palestinian groups as terrorist organizations should be easy for liberal democracies to condemn. The designations were handed out based on secret evidence and came without any due process. The organizations in question are highly respected locally and well integrated into the international human rights scene. But the EU, US, Canada, and UK have yet to explicitly reject the Zionist regime's shabby attempt. In the words of Zayd Raad al-Hussein, the former UN High Commissioner for Human Rights, to sully the reputations of Palestinian human rights defenders. None of these governments appear convinced by the Zionist regime's accusations, but they have not even given their ally a deadline to present credible evidence justifying the designations aimed at starving those groups of international funding. Thank you. And in its attempt to isolate and marginalize these groups, some of which provide key services to Palestine's most vulnerable communities, the Zionist regime is profoundly upending the lives of the human rights and social service providers in its crossers. One of those human rights defenders is Khatam Safin, the president of the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. In February, Safin was sentenced to 16 months imprisonment by an Israeli regime military court. She was already in Israeli regime detention and had been since November 2020. Half of that time was spent in administrative detention without charge or trial. When the Zionist regime finally did level charges against Safin, they alleged that she was helping to oversee the transfer of funds from the now-outlawed Palestinian groups, including the Union of Palestinian Women's Committees, to the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine. As is typical of its cases against Palestinians dragged through its military court system, the Zionist regime's case against Safin relied on secret evidence to which neither she nor her lawyer were privy. Like many Palestinians denied due process in the Zionist regime's military court system, Safin agreed to a plea deal that dropped the money laundering charges. She was convicted of membership in the PFLP and to being president of the now Union of Palestinian Women's Committees. The Palestinian human rights group Al-Wamir observes that the Zionist regime initially leveled a long set of inflated charges against Safin, well beyond any singular specific act she allegedly carried out. This is another time-worn Israeli regime tactic. Inflating the number of charges is a practice widely used by the Zionist regime military prosecution to extend detention and trial procedures as a punitive and coercive measure against the detainee, Al-Wamir adds. In other words, the Zionist regime throws a spaghetti pot of charges at the wall and very little sticks. But deprived of anything resembling a fair trial, Palestinian detainees agree to plead guilty to lesser offenses they did not commit to curtail their ordeal and time away from their families. The Zionist regime also pressures Palestinians to accept IDEA plea deals in order to avoid having to prove their case against them in court. When Palestinians don't accept the plea deals, the process drags on. Muhammad Al-Halabi, a charity worker living in Gaza, is a case in point. On seemingly unending trial, Al-Halabi has been detained for more than a half a decade, and his case has gone to court some 170 times. Al-Halabi has turned down numerous plea deals, refusing to admit guilt for a crime he insists he did not commit. That is the hellish ordeal that Safin 60 was facing, and it was what Jonah Reshmavi 63 was up against when she took a similar plea deal that saw her sentenced to 13 months in prison for her work with the Palestinian Health Work Committees, a group declared illegal by the Zionist regime nearly 2020. The Health Work Committees was not informed of the designation until the Zionist regime began an escalated campaign against the organization, arresting its director, Shata Odeh, and closing its headquarters in Ramallah, the seat of the Palestinian Authority in the West Bank. Odeh 60 has been in Israeli regime detention since occupation troops stormed her home in July last year. The charges against Odeh primarily revolve around her leadership role in the Health Work Committees, according to Al-Wamir. Odeh is also the chair of the Palestinian NGO Network, a coalition of dozens of Palestinian civil society groups. Adamir argues that the arrest of Odeh indicates the Zionist regime's increasing brazenness in clamping down and criminalizing Palestinian human rights defenders and civil society organizations that challenge the Zionist regime's settler colonialism and apartheid. Ultimately, the terror designations and the Zionist regime's long-standing campaign against Palestinian human rights defenders is aimed at preserving its impunity. The Zionist regime's moves against these individuals and groups is also a sign of desperation that it is losing its grip on the narrative, with a growing consensus among international human rights groups that the Zionist regime is practicing apartheid against Palestinians. Shawan Jabarin, the director of Al-Haq, one of the targeted organizations, told a panel recently convened by the Carter Center, "We removed the mask from their faces. Global human rights consensus now holds that the Zionist regime is a colonial regime. This is an oppressive regime. We crossed the red lines when we came to the issue of accountability and going after the Israeli criminals," he added. During that same event, Wessam Ahmad, also with Al-Haq, noted that the terror designations and other moves against the Palestinian groups are being issued by the same Israeli regime officials being investigated by the International Criminal Court. The movement at the level of the International Criminal Court is something that the Palestinian civil society organizations such as Al-Haq have been heavily involved in pushing forward, and despite the Zionist regime's attempts to stifle the progress towards this investigation, it has continued to move forward. Ahmad said it comes as no surprise that the Israeli regime would take such action during the process of investigation at the ICC. It's very much a reflection of the apartheid tactics to persecute those organizations and individuals that are seeking to challenge that regime. Meanwhile, the Zionist regime's repression of human rights workers will only escalate as the investigation progresses, and with no pushback from Israeli allies, who seem happy to uphold international law when it suits them.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim. Dini Islam, Dini, Walla, Ghairu Dini, Muhammad Illi Hadini.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. Uh, We're going to talk about, in fact, some of the rules related to fasting and Ramadan, since we are in the month of mercy, in the month of barakah, and in the month of Ramadan. So we're going to deal with this, in fact, according to the fatwas issued by Ayatollah Khamenei. But before that, let's take a listen to a short biography. A little bit of background about Ayatollah Khamenei. He was born in 1939. When he began his Hawza studies, it took him 5.5 years to finish the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh. The standard time for studying the Muqaddamat in the Sutuh for an Iranian student that is not raised with the Arabic language is about 10 years. At the age of 18, he starts attending Bahthul Kharij. Bahthul Kharij, he starts it in Mashhad under Sayyid Hadi Milani. For 7 years straight, he was in Qom studying under Ayatollah Burujerdi, Imam Khomeini, the son of Ayatollah Ha'ari, who set up the Hawza in Qom, Sheikh Murtada Ha'ari, which was one of the top figures in Qom. Then he went back to Mashhad. For 4 years, he studied Kharij under Ayatollah Milani again. Speaking to some of those who knew Ayatollah Khamenei in Iran, when the issue of the ijtihad of Ayatollah Khamenei came up, they said, "We testify that he was a mujtahid not now, but in 1337, that's in the Iranian calendar, 1337, that's the first year that he started his Bahthul Kharij. He was teaching also. He had classes, he was teaching makasas, some of the advanced classes in the Hawza, he was teaching that. 5 years before the actual movement started by Imam Khomeini, he was a mujtahid according to that testimony. And when the movement of Imam Khomeini began, he was part of it, he was politically active, but he also was involved with his studies, as we said. Up to 1347, he was actively participating in Bahthul Kharij of Ayatollah Milani in Mashhad. And after he became the supreme leader, a little while after that, because he was requested a lot to start Bahthul Kharij, he started Bahthul Kharij and he's teaching. One can very clearly testify that this man is no doubt one of the most just and adil scholars that would not, for any reason, for his children, for his family, for his personal benefit, for any party's benefit, for anything other than Allah, change his view and make a decision to go against what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has said because of something like that. Back to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker, as always. We are talking about some of the rulings, jurisprudential status of, Ramadan and fasting related laws according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And Sheikh Javid, would you please tell our listeners an audience about the status of, or jurisprudential ruling about somebody who's breaking his fast by some haram sexual intercourse, such as, for example, masturbation or taking haram food or drink. So what is the ruling here?
As you rightly mentioned, masturbation is haram. It is always haram regardless of the individual, you know, fasting or not fasting, because it's always necessary to avoid masturbation under all circumstances, of course. And haram sexual intercourse, meaning, having sexual intercourse during the month of Ramadan, of course. Otherwise, it's permissible to have sexual intercourse and at night, with one's own legal spouse.
Mm-hmm.
And then as far as taking haram food or drink, of course, again, you know, haram food means legally or illegally obtained mm-hmm. food, as far as I understand. So all of these are forbidden while fasting. And if a person, you know, breaks his fast using a haram means, according to some scholars, and including Supreme Leader Ayatollah Khamenei, of course, it becomes necessary for him to give not only the qadha, to offer the qadha,
mm-hmm.
but also give a penalty of fasting for 60 days, 31 days continuously.
Mm-hmm.
And then as an obligatory precaution, he should also feed 60 poor Shia Muslims. And 60 poor Shia Muslims, mm-hmm. not only 60 poor people.
Mm-hmm.
So he has to find, you know, it's very important to understand that it's not permissible to give 60 portions of food to one individual.
Who's a non-believer, for example.
Or to one Shia Muslim, you know. If you want to give, for example, 25 kilos of food, or let's say 60 portions of food to one person or one family, it's not sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
You have to look for 60 different people, 60 different Shia Muslims,
yes,
who are truly Shia Muslims, you know.
That would be strenuously hard, in fact,
difficult.
Especially in non-Muslim countries.
Especially in non-Muslim countries, it's very difficult to locate, you know, these number of Shia Muslims. And so this is a penalty, you know, that's why it becomes very difficult. You can, for example, you can fast for 60 days, okay, and it's still very difficult to fast for 60 days. But also, it's difficult to find 60 Shia Muslims.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's not necessary for a Shia Muslim to give food to poor Shia Muslims in one's own city.
Mm-hmm.
It is permissible to send the money to a Shia brother or a Shia relative or someone, a friend, who lives in a poor Muslim country.
Area, yeah.
Yeah, or in a poor neighborhood. And he can actually deputize him, tell him to act as a representative on his behalf to give food to 60 poor people.
Mm-hmm.
And this can be possible. For example, yes. You live in Europe, you send your money to somewhere like Pakistan or Afghanistan or any poor countries where there are lots of Shia Muslims who live from hand to mouth.
Yes. Okay. Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. Let's take a short break and we'll be back and continue our program on RIB English Radio. Don't go away.
La ilaha illallah, Allahu Akbar.
The followers of Ayatollah Khamenei can refer to leader.ir/en. In the section Religious Affairs, you can ask your question and receive the answer. In the library section, some of Ayatollah Khamenei's works of jurisprudence are available, including Practical Laws of Islam, Frequently Asked Questions, Comparative Fatwa, and Newly Asked Questions.
Back to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Sheikh Javid, our guest speaker. We are talking about some of the Ramadan or fasting related jurisprudential laws according to Ayatollah Khamenei. And before the break, Sheikh Javid, I asked you about the masturbation, which is a haram act and sexual intercourse, basically, or a haram act, obviously, or taking haram food. And you mentioned that it requires, in fact, kafara, right?
Yeah.
But quite similar to this question, if a husband asks his wife, in fact, to masturbate for the husband in the month of Ramadan, is it still haram or it requires, kafara or what?
You know, during the day of Ramadan, when both the husband and the wife are fasting, it's not permissible for the man and his wife to engage in a sexual activity which results in ejaculation or in the in sexual intercourse. That mm-hmm. is that's for sure.
Yes.
But okay, kissing, hugging, and you know, on what we know as foreplay, mm-hmm. foreplay is allowed. Provided that one makes...
Although reprehensible, right?
Yeah, it is reprehensible to, you know, to engage in such sexual activity, you know. But it's not haram and it does not make the fast void. So as long as you are confident that it's not going to lead to ejaculation mm-hmm. Of semen. And of course, if a woman wants to masturbate for her husband, that's not permissible because self-gratification is absolutely forbidden. No matter what the excuse may be, it's not permissible. Okay, if in the month of Ramadan and during the night of Ramadan, if, let's say, a woman wants to help her husband to ejaculate and she's not willing, or maybe the man is not willing to have sexual intercourse during the night of Ramadan, of course, the wife can actually help, you know, her husband ejaculate. She can use her hand and to help her husband to ejaculate. That's not forbidden.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
I see. I know that you talked about, in fact, injections and the jurisprudential status of injections, and would you just very quickly talk about it again, because some of our dear audience may wonder what the ruling regarding, in fact, injections is. Very quickly, please.
You're right. It's one of the frequently asked questions, especially in this time around when the number of sick people suffering from, let's say, coronavirus infection is on the rise. You know, according to Supreme Leader Grand Ayatollah Khamenei, it is based on obligatory precaution for the fasting person or to avoid having any kind of, you know, supportive, nutritional or intravenous, you know, injections. So mm-hmm. we understand from this that there's no fatwa. This is just an obligatory precaution. And you know, the same rule is applied to all kinds of intravenous fluid infusions, you know. But Ayatollah Khamenei says that there is no problem in using non-nutritional intramuscular injections like antibiotics, painkillers, or anesthetic, you know, injections. These are permissible.
Okay, thank you very much, Sheikh Chabid. Thank you, dear listeners, for listening to the program Islamic Laws on IRIB English Radio. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 25 meters, 11,865 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.